The CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, The Great Escape, Access versus Ownership and Ed Sheeran. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hi, Chris Cook.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm good.
How you been?
I've been good.
Good.
We've got an unmovable deadline on this week's podcast for two reasons. Reason number one, someone needs to get into this studio in, 48 minutes' time.
Yeah.
So our podcast cannot be longer than 48 minutes.
Which is good news for everyone.
Which is good news for everybody. Also, because I knew we had to start bang on time, because we had to be out of the studio bang on time, I didn't get any lunch on my way in, because I knew that would delay me. What I didn't anticipate was then sitting here for 5 minutes waiting for your good self. But, so therefore I haven't had any lunch, and I'm very hungry, so we need to get this podcast recorded so I can go and buy some food.
Okay, I ate on the way here. If anyone was wondering,
I'm not interested. So, we're going to talk about The Great Escape in a moment, but before we do that, before we plug our own event.
Don't ruin my teaser.
Well, you've just said it in the intro that talking about The Great Escape.
Yeah, but no one's actually listening at that point.
It's not a surprise. Also, the metadata, however you are consuming this podcast, whether it's through a podcast app or through Audioboom or SoundCloud, it says on the player what we're talking about.
That's all very interesting, but also the first section isn't in the teaser coming up, so all of what you said was redundant anyway. Carry on, what do you want to talk about?
Before we talk about our conference, CMU Insights at The Great Escape, I went to another conference this week because it's that time of year where there's just conferences galore. Although I am only going to talk about the panel I moderated. So if you're thinking that this was being unusually unegotistical, no. But I went to the Green Events and Innovations Conference, which takes place in Kensington. That's in West London. It's sometimes, when you're based in Shoreditch, it feels like you're going quite a lot further than West London, going to Kensington, but it is in West London. Yep. And so you're probably aware, because you've very much got your finger on all of the pulses, that the International Live Music Conference is going on as we speak.
I'm well aware of that.
Or at least as we record this. So that's the big live industry conference. And sort of before ILMC gets properly underway, there's some other sort of fringe conferences that occur. And my favourite of that is the Green Events and Innovations Conference. This is the second time I've been to it. I moderated a panel there 2 years ago. And this time I moderated the finale panel.
Wow.
Because this is an event that knows to put the best thing last, clearly. Also, I said that I was really busy at the start of the day, so could I go late? In the schedule when I was invited to moderate. But in doing so, I got, I think, one of the best panels. So it's all about making festivals more sustainable and environmentally friendly so that we don't put on festivals where we're all right on at this festival. It's all about, you know, making a better world. Oh, but look how much pollution we've pumped out into the world by gathering in this place. So it's lots of festivals, mainly independent festivals, it has to be said, who go above and beyond in trying to make their events as environmentally friendly, or to use the more modern buzzword, sustainable as possible. So that's what the event is about. And so I interviewed... I spoke to three people, each representing a different project from a festival last year. So three festivals have done something very interesting. Actually, I say last year, in recent years, around making their events more sustainable. So I spoke to Chris from the Shambhala Festival. So that was a UK person. And did you know that last year they went meat-free?
I did not know that.
At their festival. And fish-free. So don't be thinking that the get out there was eating fish for 4 days.
It was not a pescatarian festival.
It was an entirely meat and fish-free festival. And they decided to do this not necessarily because of sort of the animal cruelty line, although they'd always had policies. All the meat on site had to be organically produced, etc., etc. But this was also the climate change thing, because as you know, as a very informed person, all the carbon that we pump out from our power stations is nothing compared to what factory farming is doing to the environment in terms of mainly the methane gases that are pumped out. And actually, that's way worse. So even if we were to fix all the power stuff and the car stuff and all of that, because we keep eating so much meat, then that's contributing to the problem. And so they thought that a gesture in the right direction was to make the event completely meat-free. It had nothing to do with booking Morrissey, which is the usual reason for taking your event meat-free. And so he was talking about that decision and the implications of that decision. They announced it 2 weeks after they put tickets on sale, so quite a few people had already bought tickets. But only two people asked for a refund on the back of it going meat-free.
What sort of, like, I couldn't possibly not eat meat for 2 days or
well,
3 days.
I think it might be 4 days in
four
total.
4 days?
But, well, obviously...
How could you go 4 days without eating meat?
not everybody has an adventurous diet like myself. Obviously, I'm famous for always looking to try new foods and new things. Yeah. So for me, the idea
what you're known for.
Of being to give up what I'm familiar with and just eating brand new stuff for 4 days would be big for me.
But eating vegetables isn't brand new stuff. Maybe for you, but...
Well, I only eat free vegetables, don't I?
Oh, yeah.
So let's hope there was lots of broccoli, cauliflower and carrots on the menu. Otherwise, it would have been a disaster for me. But anyway, it all went very well. And the tricky bit was that they had various suppliers who'd had stalls at the festival for a number of years, and some of them could change their menu to fit with the new policy. But obviously, some festival food concessions, well, they're cool things like, I don't know, Porky Pig's Hog Roast House. And obviously that seller isn't going to be able to amend their menu to fit the new policy. So some concessions they had to say, sorry, we've loved working with you. We love the fact that you do organic farming and you're the best farmers in the world.
But you're still evil.
You're still not allowed anymore because we're now a meat and fish free. But they said they did a survey of ticket holders and 70% of the people who surveyed said that they were not vegetarian. So a 30%. I suppose it's the sort of festival where probably you've got a higher veggie numbers amongst your people going anyway. But 70% were meat eaters. And of the 70%, half of them, so 35% of the people attend the festival, said post-event that actually they had changed their diet. They were having more vegetarian dishes as a result of their experience at the festival. So therefore, that's sort of, you know, trying to make an impact beyond what is happening at the event. They are planning on now doing another survey of the same people to see whether they've kept that up. Or whether it was just something they did for an experimental few weeks after the event and then they went back to burgers and pies every night of the week. So that was an interesting project that was explained. And then very quickly, the other two things, we had Lucy Legan, who works with the Boom Festival in Portugal, which is particularly known for its environmental initiatives. And she was talking about how they built this construction that filters all the wastewater and it's a really environmentally friendly way. Basically, they got a load of Brazilians to come over. Because in places like Brazil, there are lots of villages where they don't have big sewage plants, so they build these more natural way of processing the water. And so they got these Brazilians to come over and to build one of these for the site, and that's now how they filter the wastewater on their festival site. So that was all very interesting, quite scientific. And then we had a guy called Mikael, who works at Roskilde Festival, and he was there to talk about, well, you know how one of the big environmental issues for all festivals these days, because you see the photos every summer. At the end of the festival, all the people who are camping these days, rather than on the last day, like I used to do in the days when I actually went to festivals, where you roll up your tent, even though it's damp and horrible, and you put it in your rucksack and you carry it home. These days, everybody buys dirt cheap tents from the supermarket and then they just dump them.
Yeah.
And you end up with that sea of camping crap that all these selfish so-called music fans leave in the fields. And so they have an initiative for part of their campsite, and it's run by students from a local college, where you have to apply to be part of this special community as part of the campsite. And as one of the things in the application, you have to say how you're going to be more environmentally friendly while you're there. And they basically showed an aerial photo of the end of the festival of two bits of campsite next to each other. And one bit was just a sea of tents, and the other bit was absolutely spotless. And it was talking about how having this sort of community feeling, and by having people applying and feeling like they're part of a special community, the result of that is that they also tidy up their campsite. So that was a very interesting initiative. Another conversation that then occurred, and I'm not going to say who was participating in this conversation because they didn't want to be named, but some of the people in the room who then joined in once we started talking about campsites were talking about, in terms of what the site looks like at the end of the festival, and this sort of segues into Great Escape, what substances are consumed on the site can have an impact on what the site looks like at the end of the festival. Right. And if you've got an audience who are basically smoking dope for the whole festival or sort of doing the LSD type thing, you'll normally have a really tidy sight at the end of the event. And it's when you have people drinking beer for 3 days that you just end up with crap everywhere.
Well, there's a lot of rubbish generated by beer, isn't there?
And but then some people did say, but if you've got an audience around ketamine, not only is there rubbish everywhere, the entire site is just trashed. So that's an interesting part of the drugs conversation, which we're going to be having at the Great Escape this year, is the impact it has on the atmosphere at the event and what happens to the location where the festival takes place based on what they are consuming. And a couple of people said there are some European festivals now who ban spirits on site. You can't buy spirits at the bars. And I don't know whether they enforce that in terms of people taking drinks into the campsites and stuff, but because there is evidence to suggest that people get much more aggressive when they're on spirits versus beer, lager and cider and whatever. So that was a very interesting part of that conversation. So it's a great event. So if you are interested in festivals or environmental sustainability stuff...
You'll have to wait till next year now.
You will have to wait till next year, but the years go by so fast.
They do, don't they?
So fast. And so it usually precedes ILMC by a day. And it's organised by the guys between the A Greener Festival Initiative that we've reported on in the CME Daily over the years. So amongst other things, they do that thing where they go and investigate the operations of festivals and then give them a certain level of award, a kite mark, basically, to say, well, this festival's really green, this one is pretty green, this one's super green. So that is something that's important to you. That can help you when you decide which festivals to go to. So it was a great event.
It does sound really interesting. And speaking of interesting conferences, we will be speaking about one in about 15 seconds time.
Yes, the aforementioned teaser. You've got your 15 seconds to tease.
Well, this week we're going to talk about new stats on access versus ownership in entertainment retail, and plus how Ed Sheeran is ruining the charts for everyone. But first, as previously stated...
Consider yourself teased.
We're going to talk about the CMU Insights Conference at the Great Escape. Quite a scoop we've got here.
Yeah, how did we... we got the podcast
you
exclusive
on this. You did some real
this.
Journalistic legwork to get this one.
I did. No other podcasts are allowed to talk about this before the CMU podcast has spoken about it. But now, once this podcast is out, all the podcasts will be talking about
they
it.
They will, I'm sure.
Every podcast, whatever podcast you're listening to in the next couple of weeks, this is what they'll be talking about. But you heard it here first, I think is the point. That could become our new slogan. You heard it here first.
Because we made it up.
Because we're plugging our own stuff. So yes, we announced a bunch more stuff about the four conferences that CMU Insights is presenting as part of the Great Escape Convention this year. A whole load more bands were added to the festival lineup. I don't think it's quite complete yet, but it's an incredibly long list already. So if you're coming to the Great Escape...
If you like bands, Brighton's a place to be.
Start digesting which of those you're going to see. But in amongst all of that, we made a number of announcements about what we're doing on the convention side this year. And as we previously discussed on the podcast when we announced this earlier in the year, we basically present four separate conferences as part of the CMU Insights Conference of the Great Escape. Four conferences in one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the slogan.
Yeah.
So our four conferences are, well, obviously, Andy can tell you what the four conferences are because he remembers these off by heart.
Media.
The media conference.
Drugs.
The drugs conference.
Rights.
Nope.
Royalties.
The royalties conference.
And...
Yeah.
The other one.
And the other one. It's the other one I'm particularly excited about. Go on, have a guess.
Going global.
But what
like
that would be, what would that be?
If export.
The export conference. Export. There you go. Well done. I'm going to get it printed on a T-shirt for you. Or I'll wear the T-shirt.
I roughly remembered.
Because then you can read it off my T-shirt. Those are the four conferences we're presenting. So it's two rooms, 2 days. And so on the Thursday, we will be presenting our media conference and our drugs conference. And on the Friday, our royalties conference and our export conference. And actually, the full schedules, that is to say, what we're going to be talking about in each of those is now available online. So if you go to cmuinsights.com and click on the Great Escape buttons, or if you go to greatescapefestival.com and click on the convention buttons, you will find the sort of full running order of the various conversations that we're going to have and the order in which they are occurring. But we're also slowly adding the speakers on there. So we're drip feeding out announcements on who is actually going to be participating in those conversations. And so we had five sort of announcements this week, which will quickly speed through. So I'm going to do them in reverse order.
Ooh.
From how we published it in the CMU Daily and on the CMU Insights blog. So first of all, within the export conference, we are looking at Brexit.
Because it's a big thing, isn't it?
It is a thing. And despite, I think, most people in the music community still secretly hoping that it will all just go away. I don't think it is just all going to go away. And so we've got Ian Moss, who is Director of Public Affairs at BPI. And I moderated a panel on Brexit not long after the referendum for the BPI last summer. And Ian was on that panel. And I mean, Ian does all of the sort of the lobbying and the political stuff for the BPI. So he has a really good understanding of what exactly the Brexit process involves. And so he will basically walk our audience through, well, what's happened already. Not a lot as yet, but it could well be that by May, a number of things have happened, assuming the government go through with what they've said they're going through with. So we'll look at where we're at in the Brexit process and then what the next 2 years is going to look like, the various things that are going to have to happen in Europe in order for the UK's exit to be enabled and any subsequent deal to be done. And so he will present all of that. So everybody in the room will be an expert in Brexit and all of their worst fears can be confirmed. And then that will then inform the conversation that will follow, which will basically be looking at the impact that the UK exiting the EU will have on the music industry, so on things like copyright law, on the moving of physical products around Europe, and the fact that we produce most of our CDs in Eastern Europe. Mm. What impact will that have on that sort of stuff? And of course, the thing that I think most musicians are most worried about, which is, what about touring around Europe, and will there be new bureaucratic paperwork for going into the EU post-Brexit? That is the first thing we announced this week.
Sticking with live, we're going to be looking at why some artists are shunning the collective licensing system for their live performances.
We are indeed. Now, anyone who came to the CMU Insights Masterclass on key developments in music rights this week just gone already knows all of this, because I explained it brilliantly, I think. I did a really good diagram and everything.
Will you be bringing out that diagram again?
I may well be bringing out that diagram again.
Something to look forward to.
I like to get repeat viewing out of my diagrams once I've made them. So yes, this is the increasing trend of particularly big name sort of heritage act. When they go on tour in Europe, traditionally the copyright bit of gigging, so that is to say the royalties that are due for the live performance of the songs at the show, have generally been paid through the collective licensing system. So in the UK, that would be PRS. In France, it would be SACEM. In Germany, it would be GEMA, and so on and so forth. But there are a handful of artists now who are shifting over to direct licensing in the live space. If you don't know what that means, well, come to this session, and I will tell you what it means. But more importantly, we'll be joined by a guy called Adam Elfin, who runs a company called Pace Rights Management. And he's basically looking after the administration of this for a number of the artists who have already done this. So, for example, Deftones have done it. Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits have done it. And he's been basically organising it all and sorting out the administration and the deal-making. And so he will explain, A, why these artists have chosen to go that route. And that's quite a story. And B, he'll be describing the mechanics of how it works. So if you are involved in the live space, particularly in the festival space, this is an added little complication that's coming your way. So come and find out why it's happening and how to deal with it.
Back to export. Say you're an artist who's doing well in your home country. Say that's the UK. And you want to go worldwide with your musical wares. I'm going to tell you how you do that.
We are indeed. This is the Want to Go Global strapline that reminded you that we have an export conference. So there's this thing called the Music Export Growth Scheme. I don't think we've ever spoken about it on the podcast, but we've written about it in CMU Daily. So it's ultimately a government-funded initiative that is then administrated by the BPI, where they provide funding to artists who are doing well in the UK but feel that their opportunities abroad, whether that's to record abroad, release abroad, market abroad, perform abroad, but need a little bit of help in order to sort of build that export business. And the MEGS program provides funding to management companies and to sort of smaller independent labels to help with that. And so basically the MEGS scheme's been going for a number of years now, so we're going to get some of the managers and labels who've had that funding to come in, talk through their projects and the lessons learned, and over those case studies we will provide a checklist of things that managers and labels should be doing if they're taking their artists overseas for the first time. And so amongst the people who'll be talking will be David Manders from Test Squad Recordings, who works with Public Service Broadcasting, and Julie Weir from Gourmount. She works for various different projects as well, but specifically talking about the exporting Fearless Vampire Killers and that project. So that is what we'll be learning from in terms of getting a new artist launched abroad.
Get into more contentious realms. We'll be asking, will it be streams that kill the radio star? Is streaming going to be the death of radio?
Of old school radio, because Spotify in particular, but also Apple Music and the others, are becoming more like radio services. They're doing more curation, but more importantly, they're moving into the original programming space. And certainly for a younger audience, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music between them are sort of fulfilling the role that AM FM radio would have done for a young generation 10, certainly 20 years ago. So what does that mean for the traditional radio stations? Will those younger people who are shunning radio ultimately grow in to be radio listeners, or have they lost that generation forever? So what can traditional radio people be doing? And so we'll have various people coming at this from different angles. We'll have Matt Deegan from, his company called Folder Media, but he also runs the kids radio station, and he is a real expert on all things. Basically, whenever those radar figures come out, read Matt Deegan's analysis of it on his blog, because he really understands the radio industry. We'll have Simon Cole from 7Digital, because 7Digital is a really interesting company in that in the music industry, it's generally known more for its powering of music services, of download services and digital services within record companies and music publishers. That's generally what people know 7Digital for. But of course, 7Digital is also actively involved in making radio programs, and indeed
they have studios.
They
apparently
have studios where some really good podcasts are recorded, I hear. So it's a company that really sees both sides of sort of, you know, the streaming and what's happening in that market, but also traditional radio. And so we'll get some really interesting insights there. And then we will have Nats from Platform B, which is a brilliant new radio initiative happening in Brighton, which is involving engaging young people in creating radio programs. And so she will give her insights of working with young people on making radio programming that young people actually want to listen to.
And then quickly, lastly, what's our fifth thing we announced this week?
So transparency, we talked about this on the podcast last week.
We did.
So you know all about this debate, but we'll be carrying on the debate at the Great Escape at the end of the Royalties Conference. So Annabella from MMF, Music Managers Forum, will be leading that debate with myself. We'll be discussing the Dissecting the Digital Dollar report that came out last year and some other research that is ongoing as we speak. And we'll also be joined by some artists and some songwriters to discuss what it is that they need access to when it comes to the way digital income is processed. And then we'll have some of the labels and publishers who are innovating in the space of sharing more information with their artists and songwriters and helping them digest that information will also join us for the debate. So yes, some Brexit, some direct licensing in live, how to go global with your artists, what's the future of radio, and why can't the labels and publishers be more freaking transparent are the sessions that we have confirmed the speakers for. But if you go online, you'll find out the full schedules of conversations due to take place at our four conferences. And before we wrap up this section, Andy will just remind you one last time what the four conferences Seeming Insights are presenting at the Great Escape this year.
Media, drugs, royalties and exports.
Oh, I can't wait.
Still to come, we got our news in brief and the shock news that people like Ed Sheeran. But now, let's talk about access versus ownership.
This feels like a really old debate, but in the early days of digital, it was the conversation that was often had at conferences and stuff like that, which was there are two kinds of digital music services. There are access services and there are ownership services. Which one will dominate in the future was the question we used to ask. And bearing in mind that this was in the mid-2000s when there was basically one digital music service. YouTube was emerging, but there was basically one digital music service, and that was iTunes. And iTunes was an ownership service. So it was like, right, ownership is the future of digital music. But how wrong we were.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who said no, people will never pay to get music they don't own.
Well, why don't you explain to us what we're talking about here? What's the difference between an ownership digital music service and an access digital music service?
Well, this actually, what we're talking about here is wider than that because it includes physical as well. The news is that the Entertainment Retailers Association put out their figures for 2016 and they found in that that across all entertainment retail, access had overtaken ownership
for the
in
first
terms
time.
Of revenues very slightly. It's like 51% versus 49%. But that basically means that more people are paying to access services like, say, Netflix or Spotify, so streaming services where they don't own any of the content they watch. They just pay a fee every month and it's there for them when they want it, versus ownership, which is obviously buying a download off iTunes or a DVD in HMV.
Yes, as you say, ownership, although traditionally we've spoken about ownership in the context of digital, so iTunes is an ownership service, whereas Spotify is an access service, but obviously physical, well, beyond rental. I mean, I suppose in the film space, there was always an access element to DVD because the DVD rental business was massive for a time. But yes, these days, when we talk about physical product, whether it's CD or DVD, or indeed gaming releases and in physical form, that's ownership. So with ownership, you pay a chunk of money, and then it's yours, in theory, for life, or until you scratch the disc or you accidentally delete your
MP3 the CD rocks, which is also...
But in theory, you've bought it, you own it, it's yours for life. Whereas obviously with Spotify and with Netflix and with all of those services, you're a subscriber, you pay a chunk of money, or you may be on some sort of ad-funded platform where actually you get access for free. But crucially, you don't own the content, and if your subscription lapses, or if it's a free service, if the service changes its catalogue, or it goes out of business, then you no longer have that content because you don't own it, you simply have access to it. And as I say, in the early days of digital, because iTunes was so dominant, the vast majority of certainly the music industry's digital revenues were coming from an ownership service, i.e. iTunes. But obviously, the big story in music and in the other aspects of entertainment, because obviously this is the Entertainment Retail Association, which also covers movies and games, has been this shift over to the subscription services and the access services.
Yeah, so these figures, so this is obviously the Entertainment Retail Association, these figures cover gaming, video and music, and we can get onto how music differs from the other two in a moment.
Yeah, so I suppose ERA's members include the retailers in all of those different aspects of entertainment, but also they do include both the physical and the digital retailers. So
yes.
From a music perspective, HMV are a member of ERA, Amazon are a member of ERA,
Spotify.
Actually, iTunes aren't, because Apple don't join trade bodies, but other download stores are, and as are Spotify and Deezer and the streaming services. So their membership, A, it's all different kinds of entertainment, because it is music, film and gaming, but also it is high street and it is mail order and it is download and it is streaming.
So they also reckon that now 80% of money spent on entertainment is spent online rather than in real life. It's all real life, isn't it?
But anyway, so just to clarify on that, that would include mail order. So that would include people buying physical product off Amazon.
Which we can come on to.
It is now, only 20% is now spent on the high street across all of entertainment products.
Yeah, for music, actually, it's slightly less. 72.4% spent online. And there are a reason for that. We'll come on to those. And so in that 72.4% in music, just over 15% is spent on physical products being delivered. So mail order, mostly going to be Amazon. 57.1% is on digital content. And if you include video and games in the overall total, it's 12% is spent on physical products, 65% spent on digital content.
Whether that's download or stream.
As you can see, what we're building towards is that music skews these figures somewhat. Actually, if you just do games and video, the access is a lot higher. In fact, games is where access is at its highest. Music actually brings it down quite a lot.
So if you took gaming out of the mix, then we wouldn't be at the over 50% access, is your point, because the shift to subscription services is happening faster with games.
Yeah, so when you actually look at just music on its own, it's actually only 37.8% of revenues is access. But I mean, less money is spent on music in total as well. So there's a whole weird balance here, but about £418.5 million was spent on music subscriptions and other access business models in 2016 versus £690 million for ownership,
which is both CDs and downloads, and of course your vinyl revival,
which again, because this is revenues, there's another unbalancing going on here, because as we saw this at the end of last year, there was again Era put out some figures saying it was first or second week of December, vinyl sold more in terms of revenue than downloads for the period of a week. And everyone went, wow, that's amazing.
And someone quoted that back to me last week. Yeah. saying, oh, but vinyl's outselling downloads.
Vinyl's
now.
Outselling downloads. But it's not, in terms of units, it's obviously not the case. The main reason was it was almost Christmas and people were buying Christmas presents. And also it was the week that Kate Bush released a £52 vinyl live album that really skewed things. So obviously overall there's an element that kind of vinyl, although it sells less, it has a higher profit margin, it sort of skews things in terms of revenue. So there are other figures to be pulled out of this that Era haven't released that would be interesting to see.
I suppose it is a key point to make. We get figures about the UK, both recorded music industry and the wider entertainment industry, but I suppose what is different between the figures that we get from the BPI versus the figures we get from Era is the BPI figures are often what actually came into the record industry, so the money that the record companies were making, whereas the Era figures are actually what went through the till. Yeah. So it includes the retailer's cut and all of the other elements to it. So that's why there are sometimes slightly different, although the trends are always the same. We always see the same trends in the BPI figures and the Era figures, the shift to streaming, the shift to subscription, the shift to access. All of that you see across the board, but then some of the percentages and actual figures are different just because of the different ways that they're calculating their sums.
There's also the fact that, I mean, I think we've mentioned this on the podcast before, that actually, weirdly, you can now buy music on the high street in more places than you've ever been able to buy it before, because so many shops, like non-traditional record shops, now sell records and DVDs. Over the last 8 years, the number of shops selling physical products has gone up every year, and last year reached an all-time high, which seems bizarre.
Yeah, and I suppose that's because, I mean, for starters, the supermarkets, who it seemed a few years ago were going way off music and were sort of, you know, getting it to like one shelf of CDs, have in the main upped the music content again. And as we've talked about on the podcast, the supermarkets actually, are both Tesco and Sainsbury's now in the vinyl game?
Yeah.
They're very far, aren't they? Plus you have retailers like that. Urban Outfitters are selling vinyl. People like John Lewis have started selling vinyl. And you've got other sort of supermarket type shops who will have a little rack of CDs. So there's not much choice. It's the big pop albums and some terrible compilations, but there are more CDs sitting on shelves. And I suppose it's all about impulse buy, isn't it? That's what's helping the physical market. It was always important for people like HMV. You go in for one CD and you buy two others, but also by having CDs in those other non-specialist shops, the idea is you're getting people buying probably an older demographic impulse buying a CD without actually going out to buy one. And that is helping keep the physical figures, as we discussed at last year's Great Escape, the physical sales here in the the UK. They're still in decline, and they're probably still ultimately in terminal decline as a mainstream product, but they are healthier than I think we would have expected them to be 5 years ago if we had been looking ahead.
So some interesting figures to come out of the Entertainment Retail Association this week. We'll see how that changes in a year's time. Just quickly time to look through a few other stories from this week. In brief, there's a big review begun on mechanical royalties in the US, and everyone is very excited.
Very excited about that. So mechanical royalties on songs are subject to a compulsory license in the US, and therefore record companies and streaming services who need to exploit the mechanical rights in songs pay a statutory rate that is set by a thing called the Copyright Royalty Board, and that rate is being reviewed for the next 5 years. The labels, who'd had a bit of an argument with the publishers on this. This is where you have the great scenario where Universal Publishing and Universal Music and Sony ATV are all rowing over what the publishers should get paid on a CD or a download. But they managed to reach an agreement last year. So the big dispute as this review goes before the Copyright Royalty Board is between the music publishers and the songwriters on one side and the streaming services and the Googles and Pandoras and Spotifys of this world on the other side as to what the statutory rate should be for mechanical rights for the next 5 years in the US. If none of that made any sense whatsoever, that doesn't surprise me. Go and read our report where I tried my best to explain quite a complicated story, and there'll be a link to it in the podcast notes.
There are some fears that changes to business rates, increases in business rates in the UK, are going to put grassroots venues out of business. The UK Music cautiously was positive about Philip Hammond's budget this week.
Although
yes, we're still not sure how music venues are going to be affected.
So the reason this was newsworthy this week was because of the budget speech in Parliament, but this change to business rates has been on the cards for a while. Venues which offer on profit margins of about 80p are worried that if suddenly the rates they have to pay to their local authority double in size, that will be, well, we've talked at great length, haven't we, about the challenges facing grassroots music venues. That could be the final nail in the coffin. So what UK Music were pushing for was safeguards for small grassroots music venues with a cultural value that will shield them from the impact. There were a handful of things that the Chancellor said in his budget speech that gave UK Music, they welcomed it, and they said it looks like there might be some protections for venues, although it was all a little bit. I mean, he just stands up in Parliament and waffles for 20 minutes, doesn't he? So it's still not quite clear what's going on here and what these measures that he indicated about are that could help. But he talked about helping pubs. So it's like, well, the most grassroots music venues are also pubs. So does that mean that they're going to get that help or not? So certainly there are some indications that venues might be helped as business rates change, although it's still TBC and it could be yet another reason why we see more grassroots music venues go out of business.
South by Southwest from next year is going to drop some wording from its contracts with international artists which threaten deportation if they muck about.
Yeah, so South by is getting underway, and one artist
told Slant,
who was due to play, actually read the contract, quite unusual, I imagine,
yeah.
And noticed that
there was no one, because this word has been in there a long time, no one's ever noticed it before.
Noticed a clause, which, I mean, they're not even an international artist, so
no,
it doesn't affect them, but basically saying, if you're an international artist and you come to South By, and South By in essence are inviting you, which is how you get your visa to come into the country to perform, but then you go off and you do those sneaky fringe shows that happen in Austin during South By that aren't officially part of South By, well, that could be against your visa conditions, and in theory you could be chucked out of the country and never let back in. Obviously, with visas and immigration being such a big issue at the moment, this band who is opposing basically read that as South By saying, hey, international bands, if you go off and play an unofficial show, we'll shop you to the immigration officials and get you kicked out of the country. South By then said, that's not what we do. It's always been in a contract. We're basically just making artists aware of what their visas say,
yeah,
so they don't fall foul of the rules. But they recognise that given the current political environment in America, that perhaps the wording could be better, and next year they're going to revise their contracts to basically remove the more draconian sounding stuff. I just hope that doesn't mean that then some artists aren't informed and they infringe their visas and they're never let back in America again. But hey, this time next year there could be a big wall around the entirety of the US stopping us all from getting in anyway. So, you know, perhaps international acts won't want to play in Austin come next year.
Now, on to a subject we've talked about a lot on the podcast, secondary ticketing. Iron Maiden reckon they've got it cracked.
Yes. Iron Maiden put on sale tickets for their upcoming tour late last year. They introduced a variety of measures to try and stop ticket touting, including paperless ticketing, not exclusively, but they're encouraging fans to get paperless tickets, which are harder to resell. And then people who buy paper tickets, they were doing the whole ID, name on the ticket, credit card, blah, blah, blah thing. And they were basically saying, well, they'd done some maths and, you know, just to summarise the maths, last time they went on tour, loads of tickets went on the secondary market, and this time, not very many at all. So they were basically saying that the measures they'd introduced seemed to have worked, bearing in mind that actually the average tour, more touting happens now than it did 5 years ago. So for most tours, the amount of tickets being touted would have gone up. For them, it went down significantly. So they were basically saying that these are measures other artists should consider. Although some of those measures have been controversial elsewhere, sometimes paperless ticketing, sometimes locking a ticket to a credit card, There are some consumer rights groups who oppose that. So some of those are a little bit controversial. Although they did say they'd had no complaints from any of the fans. All the fans thought it was great. And of course, there was a slight irony to the story that the company that's been helping them with all of this, powering all this paperless ticketing, ensuring that the big bag touts are kept out of the market, is good old Ticketmaster, owners of Seatwave, and Get Me In, two of the biggest secondary ticketing sites in the UK. So that's always fun.
Yeah, and if you want to read any of those stories in more detail, you can go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast and find the show notes for this show. And all the links are in there. And finally this week, it's Ed Sheeran.
Ed Sheeran?
Yeah, that's his nickname, isn't it?
Is that what we're calling him now?
Well, Edward Ed Sheeran, I guess.
Yes, that's what I would guess.
But I like to call him Ed, so it's just Ed Sheeran.
Ed Sheeran's got a record out.
Apparently so.
Which you might have noticed. There has been an awful lot of Ed Sheeran news. There was it Rolling Stone he gave an interview to?
Yeah.
And as far as I can see, all sort of entertainment websites and the tabloids have managed to spin about 87 different stories.
Well, they've taken every single quote in the story and turned it into a news.
So there has been a flood of Ed Sheeran news on top of all of the stats around how bloody well this record is doing. We have 4 minutes left in this studio to discuss the week in Sheeran. So tell us what's the most important Ed Sheeran news from the last 7 days since... is it Divide or Division, did we decide?
Divide.
Since Divide...
What do you mean, did we decide? That's what it's called. Just because you don't bring me into your lack of knowledge.
But when they announced this record, we had a conversation on the podcast about whether it was Divide or Division.
Did we?
Which was last year, I think. So I'm just wrapping up that conversation, because our regular listeners were wondering how that conversation would... Anyway, I'm using up your time. Yeah. Tell us the Ed Sheeran news.
Oh, he's really popular.
that's the summary.
People like him.
People like Ed Sheeran and they like his record. Hey, what's your favourite track on this new album?
I haven't heard any of them. Oh, I know, I have heard some of them because he did something at the Brit Awards, didn't he?
I don't know.
I haven't listened to the album is what I'm saying because I'm not fussed. But I'm quite interested in this Irish rap thing that he's done. That sounds quite funny. Not funny enough for me to go and listen to it, but, you know, I'm interested.
That's not on the record. This is a little side project.
No, it is on the record.
Oh, it is on the record.
Yeah.
Right, I don't know. I've not listened to it. You're in charge of Ed Sheeran news.
I've read loads of interviews with him. I've just not listened to his record.
I am
apparently
ignoring...
he realised that there's lots of people who either are Irish or pretend to be Irish in the world. And so if he wrote a song that appealed to those people, he'd probably make a load of money. Roughly paraphrasing what he said in an interview.
Well, Ed Sheeran is the sort of the king of the streaming generation. And I always like... my favourite thing about Ed Sheeran records, I don't usually listen to them, but I like looking at the track listing because I have a feeling that he names his songs based on the playlist within Spotify that he thinks his track should be added to. And there's subtle messaging going on there to encourage people to add it to their personal libraries because Ed knows how to drive streams and make money out of Spotify.
He certainly does.
So that's my theory. So there's interesting that that's other thinking going on there. Oh, Irish people will like something that's a bit Irish and they'll add it to their songs that are a bit Irish playlist on Spotify and I'll make more money. So interesting.
Yes. The actual news this week that we're going to discuss goes back to our previous discussion about access versus ownership. A lot of people have accessed Ed's album and a lot of people own it. He managed to sell 232,000 copies physically and digitally in its first 24 hours. That outstripped the sales for the first week of his last album.
X.
Multiply. By 3 days in, he'd sold 432,000. The official charts company is conservatively estimating that he will sell over 500,000 copies in the first week.
Discs and downloads combined.
Discs and downloads combined. And in fact, They included streaming equivalent as well in some of their figures.
Well, that always confuses.
So they broke it down to say 63% of sales have been physical, 31% digital, and 6% were streaming equivalent.
Have we not all agreed this streaming equivalent things are nonsense, and we just need to treat physical and download figures and streaming
figures
separately?
The official charts company has not.
I mean, I understand it's tricky to work out what to do with your bloody chart when you're trying to combine all that different data, but I think you only have to look at the chart these days to realise that it's not working.
Well, that's something we can come on to in a second.
And we need separate charts.
Let's talk about the streams.
I'll go on then.
Almost 57 million streams of the album on its first day.
Yeah, this is just on Spotify.
Which is quite a lot.
And I know most of their cheering fans are Tidal users, so I mean that's even more impressive.
That is a record for Spotify. That's a lot.
It is a lot.
The previous record holder was The Weeknd's Starboy, which got 29 million.
Yeah, take that, Weeknd.
So like double.
29 million. What a pathetic excuse of a figure.
And largely as a result of that, I would imagine, all 16 songs from the album.
There are 16 songs on this album.
And all
16.
All of them.
Including the Irish rap.
Yes. And all of them are going to go into the top 40 this week.
And nine of them in the top 10.
Nine of them were in the top 10 in the midweeks, and I imagine probably still there.
Well, who else is in the top 10 if he's got nine of the spots? They should just give him the old top 10. It would be a much nicer story. whoever's the other person in the top 10 should delete their track just to let Ed have the full top 10, because that's a nice... It's more mathematically pleasing if he is the
Well, he's also...
Top 10.
I mean, there's other stuff he's... He's ruined the album charts as well, because all three of his albums are going to be in the top 5 of the album charts.
Because everyone is now going back and listening to the previous records.
Yeah.
Because once you've had a little bit of division, you need to go and multiply something.
Yeah, and we're better to finish this podcast than on a bad maths joke.
I wasn't really intending that to be a joke. It was just an observation. So to conclude, well done Ed Sheeran for making a lot of money and screwing up the charts, or proving that the charts were already screwed up. Why don't we just get rid of the charts? I don't want to put the official charts company out of a job.
Yes, you do.
Is there something else they could do? Is there not something else they could
do? There's loads of things they could count. It doesn't have to be music.
Yeah.
There's no music in their name. They could be charts for anything.
I think that would be much more interesting if every week the chart was something.
Count everyone's fingers or something.
Yeah, or...
Which country has the most fingers?
not even in any way music-related. So not like, you know, how many pop stars wear black shoes. You're thinking just random stats.
Just as many charts as they can think of.
A random charts company.
Supermarkets with the most beans.
Well, maybe. Well, we'll pitch that to them. See if they'd rather do that. And then we can just get rid of the concept of music charts and be done with that.
Yeah, we better go and do that then.
And it's all Ed Sheeran's fault. I think we should actually go on the record. It's all Ed Sheeran's fault. Whatever happens this week, it's Ed Sheeran's fault. Including us. Gate crashing the next booking, so we really need to get out of here. So you need to do the wrap up.
All right then. Look at my note. I haven't included you in my notes this week.
No, I'm not listed.
I'll put you in out of.
Thank you.
Out of niceness.
Is that Ed Sheeran's fault?
Yeah. The CMU podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and despite what my notes say, also Chris Cook in Matt Peaty's chair this week. It's Richard Power. Although apparently Matt is going to do the editing.
Also, we've got two producers this week.
Let's not say anything nasty about him at this point.
Very well-produced podcast this week with double the production skills.
Yeah. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.